I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. Grace Chen was born with Down syndrome, but all she wanted to be was a writer. She achieved that goal, and with the help of my guest now, Judy McFarlane, published a book of her own. A new book chronicles how Chen and McFarlane met, what they worked together entailed, and has resulted in Ms. McFarlane's own book, Writing with Grace, A Journey Beyond Down Syndrome. In the book, we meet Grace, encounter her family life, see how a 24-year-old with Down syndrome leads a life that's often misconstrued, criticized, stared at, and reduced. The author's own misconceptions are bared out, challenged, and overcome. It's brave of the writer to do so because a lot of us have the same ideas, some even worse, when it comes to those who have an extra chromosome. We also have in this book the account of two writers wanting to write, as Ms. McFarlane had been a lawyer and a full-time mom, and who went on to study creative writing at UBC, where she graduated with an MFA. Judy McFarlane writes fiction and nonfiction, and her work has been nominated for the Journey Prize. This is her first book, and it's a compelling read, moving and very instructive on what Down syndrome is and what life is like for those who have it and those who have loved ones who do. It's such a great book, it's tough to put down. Visit judymcfarlane.com for more information. This book is published by Douglas and McIntyre. Please welcome to the Plant on the Line program, Judy McFarlane. Ms. McFarlane, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
You're very welcome. I've heard it referred to as Down syndrome, with the S at the end. The book refers to it as Down syndrome.
That's right.
What's the difference there?
Nothing. It's just that in the U.S. they decided to go with Down's apostrophe in Britain, and U.S. and Canada decided just to use no apostrophe. I mean, I think Down's apostrophe S is probably more correct because it is named after John Langdon Down, the physician who first discovered, or who first isolated it as, recognized it as a separate syndrome.
I see, yeah. So we're on the radio, if you will. So how do you describe someone with Down syndrome? Some people liken it to autism, but it's not, right?
No, it's not. Down syndrome, the genetic basis of it was discovered in 1959 by a French scientist, Jerome Lejeune, and he discovered that everyone with Down syndrome has three copies of the 21st chromosome. And so that can cause certain things, and it's not the same for everyone. It almost inevitably causes some degree of mental disability, but that can range from people like Grace, who are quite high functioning. She can read at a grade 5 or 6 level. And I've met people with perhaps higher levels of functioning. And at the other end of the spectrum can be people who are nonverbal. It can also cause a sort of a cascade of physical difficulties. Sometimes there are heart problems, sometimes there are gastrointestinal problems, hearing difficulties. There's a number of things that same extra chromosome can cause.
And I guess the most conspicuous is that they look just slightly a little different than most people.
That's right. There are some typical physical characteristics. Their eyes are often described as almond-shaped. They often have a slightly, especially males with Down syndrome, often have a slightly thicker, shorter neck. Their fingers may be shorter. They are often short themselves and sometimes tend to be on the heavy side, but not always. Grace, for example, is very slim.
Yeah. When a couple gets pregnant, there are tests, and there have been tests for a long time now, that mothers can endure and can determine if the child that they're bearing carries this chromosome. Is that correct? The extra chromosome, I should say.
That's right. That's right. There's been tests for quite a while. There's been amniocentesis, which was a test I underwent when I had our third child, where they extract some amniotic fluid and they test it. But now there's far less invasive tests that you can send away for a package and, you know, do a simple test at home and get an indication, not necessarily a for sure diagnosis, but it's much easier to detect now, much less invasive.
And what are the statistics in terms of people that undergo this test find out that they are carrying a child with Down syndrome? Is there a preponderance to terminate these pregnancies?
There is, in both Canada and the U.S., and I would imagine in most European countries, if not all the European countries, and, you know, probably a lot of Asian countries. I don't know the statistics for those, but certainly here it's estimated that somewhere between 85 and 90% of all cases of detected Down syndrome, prenatal detection of Down syndrome, result in a termination of the pregnancy.
And you talk to a number of people in the book who have gone on to have children with Down syndrome, and for them, for a lot of these people, including Grace's parents, it wasn't anything. I mean, it was something that they wanted to pursue, or they had to, I guess.
Well, in the case of Grace's parents, Grace's mom didn't have any tests, and you know, even today, it's quite common for women who are, say, not 35 or older, not to have a test. And so it's more often those slightly younger mothers who are now having babies with Down syndrome.
So they've already had the child, and then they find out after, right?
That's right. They find out at birth that your child has this.
There's a prominent television anchor in the city who had that. There's so much to ask you about this, and then we haven't even touched on Grace yet. When you read the book, she just comes off as an amazing person.
Yeah.
So, in terms of how she is, I mean, in the book you describe, and it's quite painful to read how she's stared at by people on the street. And how she's reacted to by, say, a clerk at the Starbucks. But I mean, when you talk to her, when you first meet her, there's really not much of it. I mean, this is from what I've read. I mean, there isn't much of a difference.
Well, no, I don't think that's quite right.
No? Okay.
You know, if you met Grace, you know, she has a hearing disability, so that causes her to not hear the endings of words sometimes, and also to speak a little bit more loudly than she otherwise would.
I see.
She also, English is also her second language, so although she's very, very fluent, it causes her to speak perhaps a little bit more slowly than she otherwise would. But from a distance, Grace is a slim, pretty-looking young woman to me. Up close, you would clearly see that she has Down syndrome. And when she begins to speak, you would realize that she does clearly have a disability.
But her disability doesn't preclude her from, say, writing. She has a job. Does she read quite a bit?
She reads at about a grade 5 or 6 level, and I think she loves reading, she told me that. And she does have a part-time job that she's paid for, she calls it a paying job, which for so many people with disabilities is such a difficult thing to achieve. You know, I think the level of unemployment for people with mental disabilities is something like 70%. It's very, very difficult. And, you know, not to create a rosier picture than reality. I mean, Grace is limited in what she can do. She's very good at tasks where it's clear what she needs to do, where there's perhaps a list that can be created, and it's not always repetitive, but, you know, she can go back and consult a list and say, oh, I should be doing this now. That kind of thing she's good at, and she has a good memory, and she also has a great willingness to learn, all of which help her in any job situation.
That's what struck me about her, is that there is this eagerness about her.
Yeah.
And, I mean, we automatically think that if one is disabled, we don't want to burden them, say, with a lot of stuff to do or to worry. But, I mean, with her, it seems like she needs that. I mean,
that's right. And I guess that was one of the great things that I learned, you know, because I guess I probably started out exactly as you're saying, thinking, how could I possibly talk to someone with Down syndrome about writing? I mean, isn't writing one of the most complex, difficult things to do? And I still think that most days. But, you know, I realized that Grace is smart in ways that I never would have guessed. She can, because of her background, she was born in Taiwan. She didn't learn English until she was about 12 when they arrived here.
Mm-hmm.
But she can switch easily from English to Mandarin and back again. She's been trying to learn French, so I've taught her whatever little remnants of French that I can remember, which are not much, but she's quite eager to learn another language. She notices a lot more than I ever would have thought.
Mm-hmm.
So in so many ways, she surprised me. When we were talking about the Titanic, and once I got past the point of wondering if she really understood what had happened to her, and it was clear, yes, she did, I found an article in a Canadian Geographic magazine, and it talked about the dangers to shipping back in those days when they really didn't have well-developed radar and all of those things. And, you know, we studied this. There was this really great map of all the incidents where ships had run into icebergs off the, they used to call it Iceberg Alley, and maybe they still do, off the coast of Newfoundland.
Mm-hmm.
And so we were looking at this and seeing how many X's were on that map. And Grace kind of looked at it, and she said, you know, why didn't they just shoot the icebergs? You know?
Yeah.
And at first I thought, well, we flipped the page, and there, yes, the U.S. Army did try to do that, and they discovered that even bombarding it with, you know, cannonballs or whatever they used really had no effect. But, you know, so that was another moment when I was really surprised and taken back by her kind of her curious mind.
Yeah, let's talk about you, because this we'll talk about you up to the point you meet Grace, because I find this fascinating. So you'd gone to law school, and you practiced as a lawyer, is that correct?
Yes, that's right.
And then you decide to have children.
Yes.
Three kids?
Well, I was bumping up that, you know, that time clock that up against, and so I had three children in 4 years, which I don't truly recommend, but anyway, that's what happened.
Yeah, okay. So so you left law, and then you became a full-time mom pretty much, right?
Well, I did. I mean, I practiced law very much on a part-time basis through some of those years, but I was also spending a lot of time with my children. I was more than ready for a change.
Yeah, and so you decided to pursue writing, is that correct?
Somewhere along in those years, I had always wanted to write, and I knew that from a young age. It was just, you know, taking the observer stance seemed to be my way of being in the world, and I always had these kind of sentences running through my head. I'd be describing something as I was actually seeing it, and I hadn't been able to really make myself go through the door of the creative writing department. When I first went to university, I found a building, I stood outside, and I simply couldn't open the door. And I think a big part of that was that my own mother, who had to quit school during the Depression but was just a voracious reader, she used to tell me that she would like to become a writer. And so I think as a young person, in some way, I sensed that if I did go through that door and I failed, I would be failing not only myself, but my mother as well. So I turned away. But there was a moment, and I'm not sure where it was. It was somewhere in my, I think in my maybe mid to late 40s, where I woke up one day and, without sounding overly dramatic, but there was a number in my head, and I knew that number was the number of years I might live if I was lucky.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a huge wake-up call. I just thought, well, if you're ever going to pursue your dream of writing, you better do it now. And so, you know, I signed up for a first-year creative writing course at Capilano College, now Capilano University, and almost had another moment of turning away as I'm driving up the hill thinking, oh, boy, you know. Yeah. It's going to be me and the 18-year-olds. But it turned out to be just a fantastic experience, and I just kept going, you know, and I went to UC and did the MFA program, and at that point realized what a beginner I was, you know, how much I still had to learn, what a craft it was, and that it would be a lifelong experience to try to get better at it.
And so was it at Cap or was it at UBC that your friend Madeline said that you should work with Grace?
Well, it was actually when I was just about to finish the MFA program at UBC.
I see.
And that Madeline called me and said that she knew this young woman named Grace, and that Grace was, I forget, roughly 23 or 24. She was at home. She told Madeline two things, the two things Madeline mentioned were that Grace had said she really wanted to go someplace besides her own backyard, and she wanted to try to write. And so Madeline just called me and said, you know, would you be willing to meet her for an hour or so and just help her get started? And that was the beginning.
Yeah. Yeah, and you go into the book, you start the book by telling us sort of the ideas that you have about Down syndrome, because you hadn't encountered anyone heretofore, right?
Well, no. I mean, I do, in my book, talk about a girl. She was quite a bit older than I was in the little town I grew up in the West Kootenays. And to be honest, I don't know if she had Down syndrome, but she did have a mental disability. And really, aside from her, and she was not in school, she was probably in her late teens when I was just a young girl, but she made a pretty vivid impression on me as someone who, even as a small child, I could see that she was socially excluded and often by herself. And, you know, some other kids would make fun of her and call her names. But aside from that, I mean, I grew up in a time when children with Down syndrome or other mental disabilities, they were not part of the regular school system. They were sent away, and they often were sent away from their homes as well to institutions where they spent their lives. So I felt when Madeline said, would you meet Grace, I felt as if I had, almost as if I'd never even seen someone with Down syndrome. Of course, I would have, but there's a marvelous book called The Body Silent by a man who was an anthropologist at Columbia University. And he was someone who developed a spinal tumor that couldn't be operated on. So he went from being, you know, completely fully able in every way to being someone in a wheelchair. And he talked about how this was a book I was so happy to find, because I thought, why do I feel like I've never seen anyone with Down syndrome? What is that? And he talks about how a disability is kind of, he calls it a state of liminality, like a state of almost like social limbo, or the phrase that I thought was so evocative was he said, it's almost as if the person with it, as if there's an eclipse of the sun or the moon that casts its shadow over the person with a disability, so that we don't actually see them. You know, they don't kind of rise up into our area of perception. We just, they're there, but we don't see them. And you know, as I thought, that must be what I've done, you know. And then when I was out with Grace, I kind of got a glimpse of that through her eyes, you know, how some people, not everyone, but some people, including the, you know, the clerk at the Starbucks, mm-hmm. could not see her. It was as if she was invisible. She was right beside me giving her order, but she couldn't be seen and she couldn't be heard. And I, you know, at first I was quite judgmental in my newly enlightened state, but I thought, ah, you know, she's doing the same thing that maybe I've done in the past. Mm. And once I had read this kind of analysis of it by Robert Murphy in his book, I thought, oh, I think right here, there's a small eclipse going on, and she can't see Grace. So it was quite a remarkable thing for me to come to understand how that might work in our society. And you know, I'm not saying everyone reacts that way. I've seen everything from kind of, you know, a few people who are able to be friendly and just say, you know, hi, how's it going? Although, in my experience, that wasn't that common. A lot of people who felt, I think as I did, kind of uneasy, unsure. What would you say? How would you talk to someone? And then I did see a few examples of kind of outright hostility, like a look that seemed to convey, I don't know what you're doing out in my world, but I don't want to see you.
Yeah. So, in the course of getting to know Grace as you have, we obviously know that she wants to be a writer, and she wanted to be a writer, and she pursued mm-hmm. that and was successful and would like to, I'm assuming, write other things. Mm-hmm. Have you talked about what she wants in terms of how she's seen in the world?
Yeah, actually, Grace and I put together, with the help of filmmaker, we made a book trailer,
yeah.
and it's going to be up on my website very shortly. But in that book trailer, Grace and I talk a little bit about this very question, and you know, Grace says that she wants the whole world to understand how she feels. You know, and in my book, I quote a poem that she wrote. Called My Real Truth, and you know, this was she wrote this after the book and after we had tried to we'd kind of tried and not gotten anywhere turning her book into a short play,
mm-hmm.
and so she started writing some poetry, or she had been writing poetry, so I encouraged her to write some more, and she wrote a poem called My Real Truth that begins, I don't even know how to describe me as a real person. And she goes on and talks a little bit about her anger. And then she says, for me, it's okay to have Down syndrome, but for the other people, I hate them to say that. My real truth is that I am smart, and the whole world doesn't know and believe in me. And I think when I read that, like she emailed that to me, and I thought, yeah, that is. That's it. She is smart in ways that the world doesn't recognize it. You know, we see, and we do this not just with people with mental disability. We do it with, you know, a homeless person sitting on our street. We do it with other cultures if they look too different. Anything that's, anyone who is, seems too different, we don't see. We just kind of have a label and we say, there's Down syndrome, there's mm-hmm. homelessness, there's, you know, someone wearing a covering over their face or their head that means I can't see them. I don't know who that person is. You know, I can't relate to that person. And I think that's what Grace was trying to say in this poem, that Down syndrome is kind of like a cloak. It hides who she really is. It makes people assume certain things that might not be true.
This is such a beautiful book, Judy.
Thank you.
and more than that, it's an informative book. It's a great service to the discussions that we ought to have in our culture and our society. There have been some reviews of it already, and some have taken you to task for the depiction of a couple of instances in the story of Grace and in your experience with her. Do you care to respond to in particular, the Quill Inquirer review of the book that actually criticized the depiction of two scenes in the book, which I won't mention because I think people should pick it up and judge for themselves what they think.
Sure. Well, one of those was a reference to sterilization. I mean, in my book, I kind of trace the history of the treatment of people with mental disabilities mm-hmm. and how we arrived as a society, you know, back in, I don't know, I guess the early 20th century, where, you know, in the U.S. there was a famous case, Buck versus Bell, that said that it was legal to sterilize people with mental disabilities, actually a whole list of people who were called socially inadequate, mm-hmm. But it was legal to sterilize them without their consent. And, of course, that in turn led to similar laws were adopted in Alberta and BC, the only two provinces in Canada where that happened. And in Alberta, they know that roughly, I think it was 2,800 people were sterilized. Not all of them without consent. You know, it's not accurate to say that, but some were. And in BC, we don't know because the records were either lost or destroyed. But that happened all throughout the U.S. Mm-hmm. and in some European countries, and I'm sure it's happening today in many other countries. You know, the criticism was that Grace did undergo sterilization sometime after I met her. I'm not sure just when that was. So she would have been maybe 25 or 26. And, you know, her mom told me that her doctor had spent a lot of time talking to Grace and obviously well aware that she needed to understand before she could give a consent, and that she had given her consent. And, you know, I talked to Grace a little bit about it because it did come up one day when I was at her place, and she does understand. She does understand that for her to have a baby would be, you know, she just wouldn't be able to look after a baby. She realizes that. And I think in a way, it's interesting, and maybe, you know, I don't know if my take on this is accurate or not, but in a way, in her book, she gets to do the things that she will never be able to do in real life. So it's possible she may get married, but it's also extremely unlikely. And now it's impossible that she will ever have three baby girls the way she does in her book. So, you know, I learned more about Grace, I began to see that her book was really, I don't know, kind of a way to experience things in life. And I mean, I think many writers do this, you know, but it was a way for her to do some of the things that were just not going to happen in real life.
The book, incidentally, is her retelling of Cinderella, right?
That's right, yeah. In her book, it's called Cinderella Grace, Vancouver Princess. She is Cinderella, and the traditional story happens. There's the fairy tale meeting with the prince and the wedding, but then it goes on, and they honeymoon on the Titanic. They get rescued in a very dramatic helicopter rescue, and they go on to become famous spies and have these three daughters. The other scene that came up in that Quill and Quire review, just to go back to for a moment, was the meeting with Grace's grandfather and in Taiwan. And when Grace was born, her grandfather on her father's side said to her parents, you know, just put her away and forget about her, an attitude very common, I think, for his generation. And Grace's mom told me that that's when they decided that they would move far away, as she put it, and find a better place for Grace. And it took them 12 years to immigrate to Canada. So when Grace wrote her book, her parents, and Grace was well aware of this story of what her grandfather had said. And I, you know, I think although she hadn't expressed it in so many words, she still carries a fair bit of anger about that, and she hasn't been able to forgive him. Mm-hmm. I think she sees it as him saying, you don't belong in this family and maybe you don't belong in the world. But anyway, when Grace wrote her book, her parents invited me to go back with them to Taiwan. They wanted to give a copy to her grandfather, and it was quite a moment when that happened.
Yeah.
Without giving away it all away, the grandfather really made an attempt to reconcile with Grace, and she was simply not able to accept that offer of reconciliation. As I say, she's still angry. She still thinks that, you know, what he said was really kind of trying to say to her, just go away and disappear.
Yeah.
So, understandable. I mean, I can see both sides.
Yeah, I can understand where Grace is coming from. I mean, we all have grudges.
Yeah.
And that's hers, I guess.
Yeah, and it's a pretty major one.
Yeah, no, and I would think, yeah, for I mean, it's a criticism or a dismissal at her core. So she has a right to be. So I guess the criticism from the reviewer was that. I guess I've interrupted you as you were trying to address it. But go ahead, Judy.
I think. I don't know. It's been a little while since I read that review, but I think the criticism was that perhaps I should have interpreted that scene more. And when I wrote it, I thought, obviously there's many ways to do it, but I just thought, I felt I had to present it as close to how it happened as it did. And I mean, I think that what I have there is very accurate. That is how it happened. Grace was uncomfortable going there. I don't give a, kind of a writer's gloss on that. I thought it was obvious to, I thought it would be obvious to any reader why she was uncomfortable and where she was coming from. So I think that was the criticism of that section.
Yeah.
But I didn't express my own opinion, but I thought my own opinion would get in the way and the readers would see what the situation was.
And the idea that she was forced to go when she didn't want to, I mean, I kind of get that because my parents are Filipino and I understand sort of Asian culture.
That
would be expected of her by her parents.
Yeah, that's right. There wasn't a choice. She was going to go.
Yeah.
And I mean, even though she said to me many times, no, he said down, and that was her way of saying he kind of dismissed me. She did go, and, she could have kicked up a much bigger fuss if she wanted, but she didn't. Some part of her understood that this was an important thing. And the other point I'd like to make is that I think it was so important for Grace as a parent to be able to do this. It was almost as if they could say, and in fact, Grace's mother, Jessica, did say this when we got back. She said, we wanted to say, look what the granddaughter who you thought, who you told us to put away has done. She wrote a book, and she said, and we knew no other grandchild had ever written a book.
Yeah, yeah.
But she said we didn't say that. So I knew even when we were there in Taiwan that this was emotionally, on many levels, very important to Grace's parents.
Yeah. And incidentally, you can get the book off of the Grace's book off of the Douglas and McIntyre website, is that correct?
Yes, that's right. That's right. Douglas and McIntyre have done a wonderful thing. They've made it available as a print on demand and an ebook. So, yes, it's there.
Is Grace happy with this book?
With my book?
Yeah.
Yeah, she's read it twice. She read it in draft form. And so I wanted to make sure that there were not things there that, would make her really unhappy or would just wrong from her point of view. And she did have a few things that she mentioned to me. But, she's comfortable with it.
And, I mean, this is your first book. It's a hell of an achievement for a first book. Have you enjoyed the process of it? And I mean, are you working on something new now?
Well, I don't know if enjoy would be quite the right word.
but it must be a great relief now that it's out and the sort. And
it is. It's, the saying of the story finds the writer doesn't find the story. And
right.
I really came to believe that with this book. If you'd asked me I don't know, 10 years ago, would I be writing this book? I never would have guessed that I would do this, and it's not a story I would have thought out, but it kind of just arrived with me, and it kind of landed on me, and it grabbed hold, and I couldn't let go. So there was something that absolutely compelled me to keep going, and then to try to understand where I was coming from. For the longest time, I wasn't even part of the story, and I realized, well, I am. The story is in large part about how I've changed through this process. So, yeah, I'm very happy that it's out there. I mean, I don't mean this to sound arrogant, but my great hope is that people will read it and arrive at a bit better understanding of people like Grace. That's my big hope for my book.
Yeah, I mean, I've learned a great deal myself reading it,
yeah.
I'm sure that people who do pick it up, who do read it, will get something out of it much the same.
Yeah, I hope so. Yeah, and so it's a bit early to start on, but I do have a thought for an idea for a novel this time,
mm-hmm.
which, you know, whichever you do, the other side looks easier from a distance, and I know that that's not true. It'll probably be equal amounts of agony, whether you call it fiction or nonfiction, but
yeah.
I do, that's what I'd like to try next, I think.
Yeah, well, writing is hard, isn't it?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think the thing is that you, at least this is how it works for me, I always have this ideal way my writing will come out on the screen, and of course, it's only rarely that you ever match the reality of your writing with this wonderful thing that you can kind of glimpse off in the distance. So there's moments, you know, when like three words line up or a sentence seems like a good one, but so often it's trying to achieve something that feels almost unachievable. But, you know, in spite of that, I think writers are driven to write, you know. You wouldn't keep doing it if you weren't driven in some way.
Judy, congratulations on this book. It's a marvelous story.
Oh, thank you very much.
Yours and Grace's, and it's just a beautiful title as well.
Yeah, I love that title, yeah. And yeah. I love the cover that Douglas and McIntyre came up with as well.
Yeah, it's terrific. The website for more, judymcfarland.com. The book is called Writing with Grace, A Journey Beyond Down Syndrome. It's published by Douglas and McIntyre. It's author Judy McFarland. Join me on the line from here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plata.